The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time for us to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. Jim, I hope your Thanksgiving Day was acceptable. What did you do for Thanksgiving?
Oh, I had family over and unveiled my new renovation of my house, so I was very happy.
Very good. Very good. Well, sounds good.
Hopefully you had a great one as well.
Indeed. I had both pecan and pumpkin, so I didn't have to decide which pie. I just had them both. You know,
I had the pumpkin and apple. I always have to have the pumpkin.
There you go. All right. The week in politics, you want to focus on the House, as Republicans indeed will gain control of the House by not by much, by just a few seats, and it's yet to be worked out, and you say that there's a couple of races we're watching, and all that may have an impact on who gets to be the House Speaker. It sets up a bit of a competition, potentially. Explain.
Well, we've got an interesting vote coming on January 3rd when the House gets sworn in or the new Congress begins. The first thing the members do is vote for the Speaker. And so they call the roll of every member, the 435, and they answer with the name of the person they're voting for Speaker. And you have to have 218 votes to become Speaker. And so with the couple of races still remaining outstanding in California, those become extremely important for Kevin McCarthy, because he's already had three Republicans who have announced they're not going to support him on the floor, which is a surprise and could actually endanger him from not getting the 218. So at this point, they have 220 seats. You know, the races in California could take them to 221 or 222 if they win them both. I think they win at least one there. And that doesn't give him much of a margin. So if he's really is losing, or if he really is losing these three that have said they're not going to support him on the floor, then this could cause him problems, and we could see chaos on that first day of the new session if he or anyone else isn't around the 218 number to become elected Speaker.
Is it possible that this is just a jockeying point where different factions of the Republican Party are meeting with him and saying what they expect or want him to do, and they're using that as a leverage point? Is it possible it's just all posturing and will be worked out by the time the vote is taken?
I think there's a lot of that going on. It's a little unusual for people to announce that they're already not going to do something. It really kind of puts them in a box. And the three members that have done this are Andy Biggs from Arizona. Now, he ran against McCarthy in the Republican conference, so they voted for basically their nominee for Speaker. And Andy Biggs from Arizona ran there, opposed McCarthy, and McCarthy won 188 to 31. So there were 31 members of the Republican Party in the conference that didn't vote for him. And so Biggs is one of the three that now says that he's not going to vote for McCarthy on the floor. So this sounds pretty serious on that front. The other two are Matt Gaetz from Florida and Matt Rosendale from Montana, which is a bit of a surprise that he would be one of the three. He hasn't been kind of a rock the boat member up until this point. So it's a bit unusual that they would come out this early and just unequivocally say they're not voting for him.
Mm. Would this have been a
It kind of puts everybody in the box. I think it's kind of odd.
Would this have been a non-issue if there had been this red wave that had been surmised or talked about by pollsters?
Yes, totally. He'd be well underway. If they were around the 230 mark, like you and I had talked about most of this year, there'd be no issue at all.
Yeah. What happened now that it's a few weeks out? Put your Jim Ellis thinking cap on, look into that crystal ball you carry in your briefcase, and, you know, give us the, as they say, the 10,000
foot level. You know what I think it really is? Yeah, well, you know what? The redistricting maps clearly worked. Keep in mind, the Daily Kos, you know, the liberal operation that does a lot of work on elections, and I always like to say, you know, their information's really good. Their conclusions are wrong, but their information is good. And what they did after all the redistricting lines were set, and remember, the Republicans looked like they had an advantage in redistricting, and they did at the early part. If you looked at all the states that were going to draw, but some of those states ended up having commissions and others had court maps because they had problems with the map. So at the end of that process, you had legislature, court, and commission maps, and that created the whole playing field we have for 2022. And so once that was set, the Daily Kos went through, and under all the new lines, they saw that 226 districts actually voted for Joe Biden on these new lines. So that was really a majority of Democratic seats that we had there. So it really wasn't a map that tilted to the Republicans. It actually tilted a little bit to the Democrats using those numbers. And I think they're accurate numbers. So the fact that the Republicans are coming in probably at 221, 222 on a Democratic map isn't bad. But I think what happened, two things. One, people, and particularly on Fox News, they were talking about 40 seats. And that was, as you and I talked, that was never going to happen. Not in a redistricting year when the district stabilized. So I think there was an overconfidence and an overestimation to begin with. And secondly, the Republican strategy, they just didn't have much of a message. There was no message as to what they were for. And I think this election tells us, once again, it's not enough not to be your opponent. You still have to tell people what you're for. And the best example of this is you look at the National Republican strategy, which was basically, we're not the Democrats, versus what Ron DeSantis and Marco Rubio did in Florida, where their campaigns were based upon giving people a reason to vote for them. The DeSantis campaign was all about people saying how much his policies have helped make their lives better. And look at the results. DeSantis and Rubio win landslide victories in Florida. And people say, well, Florida's moving to the right, but not that much. And then contrast it to the rest of the country where you didn't see that, and you see different results. Long Island is the only other place where the red wave came ashore, but that was due to the crime issue.
Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, is with us. All right, let's look at, quickly, a couple of other races. Let's talk about the L.A. mayor's race, where you have longtime politician Karen Bass defeating businessman, builder Rick Caruso. Caruso comes in with that executive experience. He's got $110 million he spends on this, and she still ekes it out. What do you attribute to that? The Democratic machine or identity politics or both or what?
Yeah, probably a combination. And you look at all of these cities, and in a year, just not in Los Angeles, but all around the country, where it was pretty clear that, at least from polling, that I guess proved inaccurate once again, that people were in a state of unrest. The right track, wrong track was heavily, the country's on the wrong track. They don't like the job Biden's doing. The inflation's bad. Everything seemed to be bad. And then what do they do when they go into the polling booths? They vote for the incumbents. I mean, we had no U.S. senator defeated. No incumbent U.S. senator lost of either party. One governor lost of either party. That was in Nevada. And in the House, in the general election, just 8 of over 380 members who ran for re-election, only 8 of them lost. And in 2 of those 8, you had a paired situation where you had two incumbents running against each other, so one of them had to lose. So really it was only six pure losses for incumbents in the U.S. House.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not something I think anybody would have thought by looking at the polling data and looking like what was unrest in the country.
Yeah.
And you would think the way the status of these cities is, with the homeless and Los Angeles being a mess and all these cities around the country that are in a lot of that same situation, they go out and vote for the same people.
Yeah, they seem to have done that. All right, to the presidential realm. We have, Trump declaring, DeSantis kind of, not saying, but not saying no. You have, all this going on. What happens there?
I think a lot's changed since the election, and I think there was a clear Republican winner and a clear Republican loser. And I think the clear Republican winner is DeSantis. His campaign was excellent, wins a huge victory, comes out on top because his result was so much different than the rest of the Republicans. And you can point to why, as I said, why. He gave people a reason to vote for him. And I think, in all honesty, that Trump was the big loser. I mean, he can take some hits for some of these weak candidates that did come through the primaries that he endorsed and helped, and they weren't prepared to win a general election. And we saw that in several places, and particularly with the Democrats hopping in the primary and actually spending money to help try to elect these what they perceived as weak candidates to win the Republican nomination. And I think that worked to a degree. And so he's definitely taking hits for that. And so I think if there is a big loser in this election, it is Trump.
How about Mitch McConnell and how he spent money to help ensure his own reelection, but maybe not the best to win elections?
Well, maybe not to win elections, but it actually worked for him, didn't it? Because he did get reelected as leader. The spending money to help Lisa Murkowski defeat another incumbent or another Republican opponent when it could have gone into a place like Nevada, where that election came down to just a few votes at the end. Yeah, I mean, I think that is he should deserve some criticism, I think, for that.
All right, Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. We will talk next week, as we always do. Thank you for your insight. ellisinsight.com is the website. Jim Ellis, thank you so much for being with us. And round out that Thanksgiving weekend with another piece of pie.
Yes, thank you, Larry. I shall.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
We are going to talk border next. The border between the U.S. and Mexico. If you watch Fox News and you see their drone footage, it shows migrants literally streaming across the border. At the same time, they juxtaposition the audio of Kamala Harris saying the border is secure, the border is secure, and Mayorkas and all that. Todd Bensman is joining us right now. His previous book was America's Covert Border War, The Untold Story of the Nation's Battle to Prevent Jihadist Infiltration. He's got a new one coming out in February. We'll talk a little bit about that, but we're going to talk about what he is working on now. Todd, it's good to have you on the program again.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I don't get it. I mean, first off, you and I have been talking before. I think we had you a guest about a year ago. And I always say, what's the deal? Is the Biden administration or Biden unaware of what's going on? Or is aware and doesn't care, or wants more people in the country? Because it seems as if you have border laws and immigration laws, you could, kind of tighten up the border and keep people from coming in, or you could not do that. And it seems like they're not doing that. And my question always is this on purpose? And from your work and your studies, what have you determined? Because that's got to be like the number one thing you wonder to yourself. Is this happening for a reason? And what do you think?
Well, for one thing, it is beyond any doubt that the president and all of his people know exactly what they're doing and know for a fact that this is the greatest mass migration crisis ever to strike the country. We are way beyond anything in U.S. history here in terms of numbers and all the metrics, which are nonpartisan. Why they're doing it is another question, because it's hard to get inside their minds, but the people that Biden brought in January 2020 are people on the really far fringe of the Democratic, left side of the Democratic Party, way in deep liberal progressive Bernie Sanders land. And those people believe, and they say it and write it and speak it, and they walk the talk, that, you know, our immigration laws and immigration enforcement are anachronistic and obsolete and are a violation of human rights. They believe that all peoples have an inalienable right to migrate anywhere they want without opposition or resistance. Nobody has a right to tell them that they can't come in to a country. And so they have immediately set about to gratify that ideology. It's kind of almost a religion with them.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I want to keep it quick answers because we only have 12 minutes.
Yes.
They word it a little differently. They'll say, you know, there's a crisis in some of these other countries. They can't find work. Venezuela, they're under oppressive rule. We have to be the relief valve. These are human beings. They kind of word it a little bit differently, but I hear what you're saying, and I had a debate with a relative of mine who said the same thing you're describing here, this human right. And my relative said, well, think of the U.S.-Mexico border. You just happen to be born on that side, and you're doomed to a life of poverty 3 miles on the other side, and you have the potential to be a millionaire. And it's like, yeah, you're right, but I still believe lines are lines. You know, and I still believe in having an orderly way of doing it. The other thing I wanted to bring up real quick and get you comment on is Schumer. Just about a week ago, right after the election, did you see that sound clip of him saying we need to have a pathway to citizenship? We need these workers. We're not reproducing in the numbers we need to in order to sustain this country. You didn't mention that argument. What about that one?
Well, that is more of a mainstream Democratic Party ideal, which is we want the labor. We want cheap labor for our industry and for Silicon Valley and, you know, for agribusiness. And I think that's where that comes from a little bit. And there is definitely that. And there's that in the Republican Party as well. So I think, you know, The problem with that is that when you grant amnesties to people who come in large numbers, that means that the next wave is going to be right behind there saying, me too, me too. And so it's problematic. You can't just be granting amnesties to people who did it wrong, because you're just going to entice the next generation of them, and it never ends.
Right. And you're just describing exactly what happens in anything that people see a loophole or a way to get it. The next group wants to do that, and I get it. And I hate to be pejorative, and here's the argument some people say is, yeah, who's going to pick the lettuce in the field? That's kind of maybe a pejorative, or who's going to change your bedpan that we have a generation of, you know, baby boomers that's aging, and there's not enough people in the caregiving business, and you know, we're aging out and not reproducing. Is there any truth to that? And does America, can it take some immigration? Here we're told that we have 2.5 to maybe 5 million that have come in. Will they be assimilated? Will things be fine? Will business pick up? Is there some good to this or not really?
Well, I think you have to draw a distinction, and too many people gloss this over, between legal and illegal immigration. We have a guarded perimeter for a reason. We want to know who's coming in, and we want to have signed off on it first. So in terms of the labor market, if there is a need in the labor market, then you adjust your legal immigration policy to account for it. You don't take illegal immigrants over the border who are breaking the law and coming in despite congressional will, which is, by the way, bipartisan, years and years of immigration law. And every country in the world has borders and expects to control who comes in. Yeah. Why should the United States be the only country in the entire world that has no borders?
So, you know, you're right. You raise that. And then, of course, the other part that's not talked about much is how this immigration takes place. The cartels that are paid handsomely per person to get them across the border, the dangers of young women being, and girls being raped on the way up, the deaths, the migrant deaths who drowned or die in the heat. None of that's being talked about, and nobody gets the Biden administration to sit down, look you in the eye, and talk about any of that stuff. So it's a complicit media as well, isn't it?
There's a great, deep, dark evil involved in all of this. Illegal immigration, mass illegal immigration, happens because you put policies out there that open the door and people will come. If you leave your door unlocked and gold in the seat, they're going to come get it, right, in your car. It's like anything else. If you don't have policies that deter people, they will come in mass. When you do have policies that are just simply irresistible, they're irresistible, then people are going to die on the way. And people are dying to take advantage of these brand new openings. If you create those openings, you are responsible for those deaths, in my opinion. People are going to die who should be alive, or people would be alive if they weren't coming to take advantage of these policies. Right.
One thing I don't get is the Biden administration and the Democrats so heavily endorse a $15 an hour minimum, $20, $22 minimum, quote unquote, living wage. And yet this large teeming supply of cheap labor willing to work and undercut that on a cash market seems to undercut that. They don't seem to fit together. They preach this idea of, oh, you're going to come to America and you're going to have all this. And then they don't always allow just anyone to take a job or work here illegally. How do they manage that?
That's a great point, man. I have no idea. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance all across the board on what's being allowed down there and tolerated. We've had 5 million people try to hit that border in the last 20 months. And millions of them are actually inside the country. And you know, half of those, we don't even know who they are. They got away. That's just a recipe for all kinds of problems. And in the labor market, the people who, there are great studies, the people who are hurt the worst are minority underserved Americans, black communities, poor, impoverished communities inside the United States that are in service industry type jobs, low skilled, low education kind of jobs. Well, those are the very jobs that the Democratic Party and the labor unions used to work overtime to protect against illegal immigrants. Cesar Chavez used to actually have vigilante groups down there on the border who would beat up Mexicans coming in to break its strikes. So that has not changed. So there's a lot of cognitive dissonance within the Democratic Party. They're hurting their own base in the worst possible way with this stuff.
Yeah. So politics. House is now going to be controlled by Republicans by an ever so slim majority. Democrats will lose that. The House is the purse strings to the funding. I am told that they have the ability, if they build enough coalition, to shut off funding for the 87,000 IRS workers and instead provide that for more Border Patrol agents. Will that make a difference? What do you project?
No, absolutely not, because the administration's primary policy here is to allow all comers to the border to apply for asylum. Once they step foot in the country, they apply for it. They can just say, I want asylum. And at that point, the Border Patrol is required to process them into the country.
His book was overrun, How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History, available for pre-order on Amazon. We'll have you back. Thank you so much, Todd.
Thank you.
Coming up, Pete Peterson joins us. He is the Dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. We will talk elections and more. Stay with us as we continue.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Pete Peterson is the Dean of the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, and he is joining us.
Great to be with you, Larry.
Hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it was terrific. Saw a bunch of the family.
Good. I'm enjoying those leftovers. I know I shouldn't, but I'm having that extra piece of pumpkin pie and all the turkey sandwiches. So anyway, a lot to talk about. Let's do a kind of afterthought on the election. I mean, we know most of this now. Are they still counting ballots somewhere? I mean, this thing just drags on and on, doesn't it?
It does, particularly here in California. Yeah, and while certainly most all the races have been decided, there still are some local races and even a couple assembly races that have not been called yet. It really is a reflection of California's election laws, which in many ways allow and really guarantee that we're not going to know the results of many elections on election night.
They've really killed the whole idea of election night coverage for those of us in the media.
Because
you go to sleep thinking it's over and it's not. And then a few days later, somebody's up a few votes and then they're down. It's kind of election season.
Right? Yeah. And I think the biggest factor in that are the absentee ballots and the fact that election law in California does say that as long as ballots are postmarked by election day, they will be counted. So that virtually guarantees that ballots won't even be arriving in some places for at least 4 or 5 days after election day. And that's even before they get counted. So we should expect that with laws like that in place, that for many of these tighter races, we may not know for a couple of weeks.
If the thought is, and we're not verbalizing it, maybe you will, to undo those laws, how do you do that? Because it's almost like once the Dems get those laws passed, any effort to change it back is like, well, you just want to change it back because you don't like the outcome and you're just trying to make it suppress people's vote.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right to say that once these kinds of laws are passed, that any thought about pulling back to what has been more traditional election administration is seen as voter suppression. We really don't see that in the turnout numbers. And I think that's important to point out that even in states where these accusations have been levied, like Georgia, for example, we're seeing some of the highest turnout rates, certainly for midterm elections, that we've seen in years. So continuing to make the case that we're very much a very open electoral process and that voters have a myriad of ways of voting, I think are ways that we can respond to those accusations.
Yeah. Pete Peterson, now that the dust is kind of started to at least begin to settle, what is your thought? I mean, I know you as an optimistic guy. But there are a lot of Republicans who feel underwhelmed by the fact that Republicans didn't take both the House and the Senate and didn't just take 20 or 30 or 40 more House seats. You know, they saw inflation. They saw an open border. You know, who's possibly going to want to keep that going? And yet it's kind of a meek result. What is your analysis?
Well, obviously, there are two lenses to look at this. One is the lens of what it is to be here in California and the other nationally. You're certainly right to say, Larry, that nationally, this very much has been a disappointment. We did know leading up to the election, as optimistic as many on the right were about the results, that many of the polls in particularly these very tight Senate races, we're still within the margin of error, even though it did show positive trend lines for Republicans. But yeah, the results in Pennsylvania, certainly Nevada, very, very disappointing there. When you look at the congressional races, it's surprising to see that Republicans really didn't make a bigger issue of the economy and issues like the border, issues like education. And so, again, very disappointing, although the what we're beginning to see on the outlook for the spring and into 2023 is that it doesn't look like many of these issues are going to get any better, whether it's the border, whether it's the economy, certainly if we look at some of these issues like education. Now, I would say on the brighter side, when we look at California, the Republicans actually on the congressional side seem to do pretty well, certainly in holding a variety of seats in Republican hands, whether we look at the Mike Garcia race or the David Valadao race up in the Sacramento area with Kevin Kiley, who's going to be a new Republican congressman. And even in the races that we lost, they were close for the first time, I think, down in the San Diego area with Levitt, Brian Marriott race. And certainly when we look at Orange County, where there was a very tight race to flip the Katie Porter seat. So, again, I think Republicans do have reason to be optimistic when we look at some of these congressional races. Of course, once again, we were not victorious. Republicans were not victorious on the statewide races. But you look at Lonnie Chen and Nathan Hochman, and you certainly do see quality candidates there.
Yeah, quality candidates, but and you were a quality candidate as well at one point as you ran for elective office. Yet, if you're just adding up Republican numbers versus Democrat numbers, Republicans are going to have a tough time because the registration itself is in the 22% range, if that, and the Democrats are much higher. And so if anybody just is kind of just a superficial voter, low information voter, and they just respond because the new norm is these ballots that come in the mail, you're going to get a lot of people who go down and just check dem, and it's going to be that much harder to win.
Well, I do agree with you, Larry, and I've said on many occasions there's really only two paths, two opportunities for Republicans. One is they need to continue to recruit courageous, quality candidates that understand that they're undertaking, at least initially, what will be a low percentage chance of winning. I mean, I salute people like Alani Chen or like a Nathan Hochman, Brian Dolly, who are very qualified individuals for those positions. You think about Lonnie Chen's race where he won all the newspaper endorsements. They obviously saw that he was the superior candidate and continue to preach this message that a one-party state does not provide the best representatives and certainly the best leaders in these statewide offices, administrators, that competitive races can offer. And then the second thing is that Democrats will have to overplay their hand just to become hyper-progressive in policy. We did see that in this past year with the approach by the state legislature to try to get a single-payer health care plan passed. That was seen as being too left-wing for even the larger part of the Democratic caucus in the state legislature. And if we continue to see low scores in education, if we continue to see crime on the rise, then there are opportunities for Republicans if they keep highlighting what they would do to improve these quality of life issues and certainly issues related to our kids.
Yeah. But, you know, if that's and that's the theory that it's got to get worse before it can get better. And I would have thought gasoline up in the $6, almost $7 gallon rate and images of migrants streaming across the border would kind of do that. Was there a fundamental mistake? I mean, I've heard some pundits say candidates ran against Biden, and although he has some challenges and appears, you know, to have some lapses and stumbles, people vote their ideology even so. Fetterman, not a great example of somebody who's robust, but he still wins. Is the fact that we have to understand that ideology outpaces the actual individual, and so if you run against an individual and you say, oh, this person shouldn't be elected because, you know, they stand for this or that, those who believe in that, those who believe in, I guess, open border or whatever it might be, are still going to vote for the person even if they have to kind of hold their nose and do it.
Well, that certainly can happen. And I think it is worth pointing out, especially in that Pennsylvania race, I think we all knew that was going to be a tight race no matter what. It's arguable that Dr. Oz may not have been the best candidate to represent the Republican side of these policy issues that you rightly point out. It is certainly the case that many people held their nose, I'm sure, on the Democratic side to vote for someone who we wonder is mentally capable of handling this immense responsibility of being one of 100 United States senators. We wish him all the best and hope that he continues to improve. But as it stands, someone who is not able to communicate quickly and readily to participate in the deliberations of Senate policymaking really does demonstrate that people were willing to overcome that to see a Democrat move forward. Now, on the particular issues, I really do think that, especially here in California, that these issues, these pocketbook issues, these quality of life issues, you're right to raise the cost of gasoline here. I honestly did not see those issues raised by many Republicans who are running for office. And I think you're right to say that if it's going to be running against Biden or even a Nancy Pelosi, that's not going to persuade as many voters as going to these particular issues and what they would do about it if they were elected.
Pete Peterson is joining us. He is the dean of the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy. Take a moment to jump into the L.A. mayor's race. I mean, I think all eyes were on this. You had someone kind of Reardon-esque from the business community. Yes, right. Granted, was a Republican, then independent, and then before running turned to a Democrat against a lifelong, you know, organizer, a Democrat, a member of Congress. And it's not that Caruso didn't have the resources to be competitive. I get the feeling he spent over $100 million. He could have dropped $150 million. There's just something about the Democrat union get-out-the-vote machine that's very hard to overcome.
Well, I think you're right. I do think one of the things that's a bit frustrating in looking at the coverage of that race, which was another one of those races where one candidate was up on election night, only to see that lead fritter away in the following days and weeks. Now, the way that it's been described is, you know, this billionaire developer spent $100 million and wasn't able to win. What we don't see is how many millions of dollars were spent by the Karen Bass campaign, but how much in kind. Essentially volunteer hours were offered by those within what might be called the Democratic machine. Even though Caruso was running as a Democrat, the machine itself, whether it be the unions or activists, were all behind Congresswoman Bass. That it would be difficult to calculate how many so-called volunteer hours were spent by significant groups of people in support of the Karen Bass campaign because they're part of that coalition.
Would you extend that to the media as well? I mean, have you seen the lauding pages of the LA Times on Karen Bass? I just can't have seen them do the same kind of thing if a Caruso had gotten elected. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point, Larry. And we're running an experiment now, right? I think Californians and particularly Angelenos are looking at this array of policy issues, whether it be crime, whether it be performance of our schools, whether it be homelessness, certainly cost of living. And I didn't really hear anything from Congresswoman, now Mayor-elect Bass, in describing exactly what she would do to improve these various issues. And so we're going to now see, will essentially the machine candidate in Congresswoman Bass, is she going to be able to respond to these issues? Is crime going to improve? Is homelessness going to be able to improve? And at least from what I'm seeing on what has been proposed, whether it's housing first on homelessness, which is shown to be a failure in a number of different cities, I'm not really hearing much on the crime issue to see how that's going to improve. And on the cost of living issue more broadly, not hearing a lot as well from the Congresswoman about how she's going to improve things for Angelenos. So, again, I'm back to what you said before, Larry. I'm afraid that in some ways things may have to get worse before voters understand that, the same old, so to speak, is not going to fix these really difficult policy issues.
Yeah. Now a moment about government's only role, and that is to redirect money, because that's what they take money from one group and give it to another group. I was in Sacramento and realized that, and all the union workers running around in their purple T-shirts, they get the FaceTime with the lawmakers, whereas those who are running small businesses are back just trying to keep things going and don't have equal representation up there. This Nuri Martinez gate, these recordings that the LA Times brought us that were discovered between a union boss joking about a variety of issues, racist comments being made, but yet probably, to me, one of the more significant discussions involving the power the unions have in keeping their power. That is where I'd like to go next, because you get a unique opportunity as you watch these elections to see how union members grow candidates, support them, get them elected, take their union membership to get them to vote for them. How come there's nothing the same on the Republican side?
Well, you know, it was once said by former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger that with public sector unions, you're in a situation in which the unions control both sides of the negotiating table. This remains a significant challenge to good California policy, is the power of public sector unions, whether we're talking about education and the fact that once again, the union-backed candidate, Tony Thurman, was victorious in the superintendent of California instruction. Certainly at the local level in LAUSD, whether we're looking at the city council in Los Angeles, which in this last election actually saw self-proclaimed Democratic socialists win their council seats. You're right to say that in pointing out the leaked audio from those council deliberations, you know, these people that were recorded, whether it be Nuri Martinez or De Leon, were seen as people that were defending particular interests, but obviously what came through on the tape was really just kind of insider, in some cases, racist politics being discussed. And so one wonders if, you know, just electing people like that is going to deliver the results that are in the best interests of all Angelenos or Californians. We see a break in the court case, the Janus decision, which may provide an opportunity for those to lure or persuade California teachers to break away from their unions. But this nexus of power between public sector unions and politicians. If that is not broken, then we are just going to continue to see the kind of political results that we experienced on this past election day.
Was the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe versus Wade a powerful tool that the Democrats found them with, and did that make the difference in this election? What do you think?
Well, I think it did with certain demographics. We did see younger voters, and particular single women, where it could be assumed that the abortion issue may be of importance to them. They certainly did vote in large percentages for Democrats. That being said, I don't know many pro-life Republicans, and I count myself as one, that if this is the cost of a truly constitutional decision in the Dobbs case, that we did not perform as well as some had estimated in a midterm election, if that is the cost, and even in future costs, that is one that's a trade-off that many pro-life Republicans I've heard are willing to make. That being said, pro-life Republicans really do need to continue to make the case for a pro-life post-Dobbs decision platform. And that's not just about reducing abortions. It is also about a broader pro-life policy to support those, especially at the lower rungs of the income ladder, whether it's through philanthropy or volunteering or public policy, to understand that pro-life is not just about abortion now. It is really now about how do we support a broader culture of life.
Very powerful what your words are, and you're right. I think Democrats also were disingenuous in their arguments about Roe versus Wade. They were like, ooh, abortion's done, you know, ooh. And no, it was basically giving it back to the states to decide.
Right.
And states like California were not going to toss it out. And so there's a politics is the art of manipulation, isn't it?
Certainly is on this issue, and you're absolutely right, Larry. And I'll just say again, one of my great disappointments from this last election cycle was the approval by California voters of Prop 1 in overwhelming fashion. I mean, about 60 to 40 supporting a measure that would add abortion rights to the state constitution. And so, again, you're right to say that I believe most Americans are looking for a more nuanced position on abortion, which I'm sure many know that under Roe, we basically had abortion law, which was akin to North Korea and other authoritarian regimes. Even some of the countries in Europe that we see as being so progressive have much more nuanced approaches to abortion and certainly to social services more broadly. And so, again, I think those in the pro-life movement, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, really need to be about defending the constitutionality of the Dobbs decision, but in policy be thinking about a broader pro-life position.
When you think about what was passed, I'm told the wording is so ambiguous that it could be interpreted to carry abortion right up to viable birth, 9 months. And yeah. It could be, it makes you be think of the former Virginia governor who was on a radio interview talking about the concept of, well, the doctor delivers the baby and they set it aside and it's comfortable. And then the woman decides. It's like, where are we? Is that where the country is?
Again, it's not there at all. I mean, all the public opinion polling that we see, Americans are supportive of the idea or the concept that there should be offered a choice to most. Most will say that there should be a choice, but there should be limits.
We're out of time. What a wonderful discussion today. Pete Peterson, Dean of the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy. I know you have a website. Share it for our listeners to find out more.
Sure. We're at on the web at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. And if listeners know of someone who's thinking about graduate school, we certainly do welcome applications now for enrollment next fall. And yeah, we're a big sponsor and supporter of Salem Radio.
Thank you much. Appreciate you being on the program.
Thanks, Larry.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.